Thank you very much for the invitation to speak to you today. I'm from the University of Waterloo. We have a new School of Pharmacy there. And in the first part of building the pharmacy, we are developing the pharmaceutics area. So my research interest and expertise is in drug delivery system development. And the types of systems that we are developing are in the micro and the nano range. And we are specifically interested in building non-viral gene delivery systems. And so this is the area that I would like to talk to you today, show you the types of systems that we are trying to build and what kinds of questions that we have if we want to systematically create better in terms of safety and more efficacious, more systems that have more higher efficiency compared to the existing ones, especially in the light of viral systems that have been shown to be a lot more toxic, and there are limitations, even though they are a lot more efficacious at the present time. I wanted to show you this general overview of what it takes to build a nanomedicine. And in terms of building blocks, pharmaceutical excipients are usually used. So excipients is a word for a particular molecular ingredient that can be used to create delivery systems that are either self-assembled or some way of structurally organized, and combine this with a drug substance that could be a traditional small molecule or a protein or a gene or a plasmid type of system, nucleic acids, to create potential drug products. These are the ones that are called dosage forms in the pharmaceutical field. These may be injectables, oral or solid or liquid dosage forms, or topical transdermal systems. And once you have a dosage form, an innovator company would have a product that is marketed under a certain kind of trade name. In the field of nanotechnology, there are a few drug products that are approved. These are the two that are presently on the market: Doxil, which is a liposome-based system, and another one, Abraxane, which is a paclitaxel bound to albumin. So these would be considered truly nanotechnology-based drug products. There are some products that are in the pipeline based on GOID nanoparticles. One is by Cytimmune. They are working on clinical trials with this material, and by Nanospectra, which are also GOID shelled nanoparticles, and these are activated by near-infrared light, absorb heat, and the heat delivered at the site of the tumor can kill the tumor cells, which is the basis of their actions. So we deal a lot with trying to select pharmaceutical excipients that would give us better delivery systems, and we use these to build different types of gene delivery systems. Okay, so gene therapy simply means that we would be able to deliver a defective, to replace a defective gene with the right gene sequence, if we can deliver this intracellularly into the nucleus, that gene can be expressed. And the two areas that have large interest is the viral vectors and the non-viral vectors. And as I outlined before, we are quite interested in building safer and better non-viral gene delivery systems. And really the challenge is to bring, even though the safety for these is better, manufacturability is better, there are no limitations in terms of how large gene sequence we can incorporate into these delivery systems, but the efficiency is lower. So that's a major limitation at the present time. In my lab, we are working on a number of different classes of soft nanomaterials, and we use these alone or in different combinations to build different types of systems. So these include lipid vesicles made from phospholipids. So these would be the type of liposomes that go back to the 1960s that were developed into different types of structures, single unilamellar type of vesicles, multilamellar vesicles, and used in different ways. We also developed a more complex systems that are called biphasic vesicles, and we use these vesicles to deliver protein across the skin, and a product that's incorporating interferon alpha is now going to phase 3 clinical trials using this technology. We also build Gemini nanoparticles, and this is the subject of my talk today, where we create DNA nanoparticles using Gemini surfactants that have cationic charge and complex with the DNA. We also work with permeation enhancer libraries to enhance permeation of drugs through the skin. There is also lipid conjugations and variety of self-assembling systems built from surfactants and lipids that we also build. And we also use carbon nanotubes alone or in composite systems to deliver drugs. Today, I want to show you phospholipid Gemini surfactant composites, the nanoparticles, and also some combination of nanoparticles with the Gemini surfactants for gene delivery. So the idea is to create systems from the bottom up, which simply means that we are taking the other way around from the viral systems, while the viral systems are produced or improved by taking out certain components that contribute to toxicity or immune reactions. We are adding component by component another ingredient to build more efficacious systems, but not have any other component that's not really necessary or could be harmful. So we are trying to increase complexity just to the level that how complex it has to be to work. We have interest in the treatment of localized cutaneous scleroderma. This is an orphan disease, and it's characterized by overproduction of collagen in the skin. And scleroderma is a thick skin disease, which means that accumulation of collagen in the skin replaces all the viable cells, and the area where the collagen is deposited is very thick and very hard to the touch. And the implication of this is that it can take over a limb or a huge area on the body, and this will cause, especially in children, a lot of loss of functionality and disability, problems with movement. It is an orphan disease, and there is no treatment available at the present time. So we use a therapeutic approach where we create a plasmid which codes interferon gamma to decrease collagen synthesis. And interferon gamma is also an immunomodulator, changing the Th1-Th2 balance, and will contribute to restoring the imbalance in the patient. Our aim is to topically apply this nanomedicine. Here you can see the area of the skin that is affected by scleroderma in these two figures. And it also shows here that the thickness of the skin becomes much bigger compared to a normal individual. This is a cross-section of the skin. The top of the skin is called the stratum corneum. This is the outermost layer of the skin, and this is the one that sheds constantly in everyone. And this is the part that peels off when you have a sunburn, and then you can just nicely peel it off. Under the stratum corneum is a viable epidermis. This is all keratinocytes that are located here. It also is a place for the immunosurveillance. So Langerhans cells would infiltrate this upon antigen entering the skin. The part that you see here is called the dermis. This is where the blood vessels and nerve endings are located in the skin. The interface between the two is the dermoepidermal junction. The cells here are called basal cells. These are the replicating cells in the skin, and they move upwards, and that's how the skin sheds normally, and it takes about 28 days for this process. So from the basal layer, one cell to actually surface as a corneocyte and shed off. In psoriasis, for example, this time reduces to 4 days. So there is a huge increase in the migration of the cells. So our problem is that how do we design systems that we can cross the stratum corneum? It's a very impenetrable layer, which means that anything that you place on the skin doesn't necessarily go through. So there are very few compounds that actually permeate. It has to be very small molecular weight, and it has to be relatively hydrophobic to cross the skin. So nicotine would go through, so that's why we have a nicotine patch on the market. Nitroglycerin goes through, so we need to we would be able to use that. However, anything that's bigger than about 500 in molecular weight doesn't tend to go through the skin. So our challenge when delivering nucleic acids and proteins, how to design some kind of delivery system or a permeation enhancer that would allow these compounds to go through. So the big dilemma in designing patch vaccines to replace needles in the delivering of a lot of drugs is how do we cross the skin surface, the stratum corneum. So a lot of people that we talk to in terms of better vaccine, they would see a lot of use for a patch or a topically applied material, because all of our children get more than 60 needles by the time they get immunized with everything that they need to get immunized for. So in the stratum corneum, in between the corneocyte, there is a lipid-rich material that's responsible for the barrier properties of the skin. And this lipid-rich material is actually arranged in a bilayer format. So in the EM, it would look like stacks and stacks of these lipid bilayers. And the molecular configuration that you can see here indicates that the lipid that is in these lipid bilayers is also arranged in a similarly to cell membranes in a bilayer format, but because of the composition, it actually has a more complicated structure due to the presence of the ceramides that have different chain lengths compared to normal cell membranes. The types of ceramides that are present in the skin can go up to 30 to 32 carbons, and they are not equal in size, so when they pair up in the self-assembling process, they can actually turn around and create a very tight structure because of the orientation of these ceramides as they are facing each other. There is also cholesterol in this bilayer, and this self-assembled layer creates a very watertight and very tight arrangement that compounds generally can't cross through until we do something to disturb the order. So what we want to build is a type of delivery system that would interact with these lipids in the stratum corneum, that we would be able to create some kind of disorder there that would allow the passing of compounds larger than 500 in molecular weight. In terms of the disorder that I was talking about, the localized cutaneous scleroderma, we have a very big clinical issue. We could say that we could inject the plasmid intradermally or subcutaneously just to get the plasmid with the therapeutic gene into the area, and we hope that some cells will express the therapeutic protein and we'll get improvement of the condition. The problem is that cutaneous scleroderma is a disorder where any physical disturbance to the the skin will further aggravate the condition. So if you try to needle or take biopsy or do any kind of physical harm to it, even more collagen will form. So we are actually counterproductive if we apply the plasmid in an injected form. So a topical dosage form would be very important for this condition. So we have two goals. Create small particles out of the plasmid DNA, which generally tends to be rather large, 300-500 nanometers if it's just uncondensed, and using some materials, and also we need a combination that will also interact with the stratum corneum lipid, so it has some permeation enhancer capability. So we build these nanoparticles from Gemini surfactants and one phospholipid that's called dioleophosphatidylethanolamine, or DOPI. That's a helper lipid. The unique features of the Gemini surfactants compared to any other surfactant that's used in pharmaceuticals, that these Gemini surfactants have two head groups, so therefore they call Gemini, and the spacer between the cationic head groups and the alkyl chains lend themselves to a great variety of compounds. So we can build a library with any combination of changes in the length of the spacer or the length of the carb, the alkyl chain. And from these chemical variations, we can build compounds that have different conformations. They have different properties in terms of their physicochemical properties, CMC or surface activity. And we can use these to screen to find the best match for building a nucleic acid particle. And we did a lot of this work. I just used three examples of these nanoparticles that we built that you can see under the electron microscope. And on the side here, you see a naked plasmid and the addition of a surfactant that's called 16-3-16, 16 for the two alkyl chains, the carbon chain length, and the three is a three-carbon spacer, and then any variation of this. So when we add this surfactant to the naked plasmid, you can within seconds see a condensation of the particles into already smaller particles, and within 15 minutes we get these 200 or so nanometer size nanoparticles that now are DNA Gemini nanoparticles. When we look at more closely the structure of these nanoparticles, we use synchrotron studies to actually find out what's the internal structure of these nanoparticles. And we see a lot of polymorphism that's happening, and there is lamellar, hexagonal, or cubic phase combinations that are possible for these different types of nanoparticles. And I show you another example later on for just the structural part. And when we look at the efficacy of these nanoparticles in vitro, what is the transfection efficiency? Is there any difference between the different Gemini surfactant combinations? We see that there is a correlation between the spacer length and the transfection efficiency, and the short spacer Gemini surfactants are more efficacious in terms of transfection efficiency than the long spacer ones. And then when the spacer length increases to 12 to 16 again, the transfection efficiency goes up. And this is an interesting from structure activity point of view, because what happens is that those surfactants that have a short spacer, they tend to have a steady distance between the two head group, but as soon as you exceed a certain carbon atoms, then what happens is that the spacer starts looping in between the alkyl chains, and then the head group again approaches each other, and it almost at 16 is starting to be at the same distance as the three spacer length. So there is a conformational change in the surfactants that causes that. We also have correlation between the alkyl chain length. The longer the chain length, the higher the efficacy. So 18 carbon chain length seems to work better than the 12. there is also, my little graph here shrank, but Of course, we are very much interested in looking at biological activity. So we build these nanoparticles in, and we want to know that it's not just working in vitro, but also in vivo. So we have a mouse system that we can use to look at gene expression in the skin after topical application. And what we found, you see the topical application versus intradermal injection of naked plasmid, that we do have expression of the interferon gamma. And the way we can see it is that in the plasmid, we have both interferon gamma gene and the GFP gene in a bicistronic format. So that means that if one gets expressed, the other one will get expressed. So if we see green, then we also know that the therapeutic gene is also expressed. We can measure the number of copies that would be in the skin as well. And what's important for us is to show that the topical efficacy is almost the same as the nanoparticles that are injected. So we don't really have to inject these nanoparticles. We get the same efficacy if we apply them topically as well. The real disease model for scleroderma is the tight skin mouse, which is this black mouse here. And you can see that this is usually how we apply the formulation. The skin is shaved, apply the topical formulation, and we use occlusion as kind of like a patch that would contain the formulation at the site. And what you see here is that the topical nanoparticles with the DNA compared to the injected free DNA control at 4-day application or 20-day application, they have almost equivalent effects. So we are able to produce an effect just after topical application. This topical application also results in decrease of the procollagen. This is important biological feedback to understand whether the particles that we build are functional. So after topical application, we have almost a 40% or so decrease after short and long-term treatment of the collagen, which is the major goal of the treatment compared to the control. The same results were confirmed through histological studies, where we look at the treatment, the thickness of the skin after treatment compared to the totally untreated control, and there is a huge decrease, significant decrease in the thickness of the skin, the total whole skin over a 20-day period of time. There is also interest in looking at what genes are affected in the tight skin mouse after topical treatment compared to injection and untreated. And we use microarray studies to try to find out which genes are affected by the treatment. We are quite interested in, of course, interferon gamma expression, whether we upregulated that or not. And we also interested in whether there is any sign for the invasiveness, that is genes that are related to inflammation or any kind of injury to the skin, whether those are upregulated or not. So we looked at a total of 110 genes at the present time, so it wasn't a whole genome-wide search, but 29 genes were found to be affected in the two populations, topical versus intradermal. And just from the heat maps, it's quite easy to see that compared to the untreated, there is difference with the topical, and there is difference between the intradermal treatment as well. And what was very positive for us to show that the tissue injury-related genes were down-regulated in the topical application versus the intradermal application. Now, what I would like to reflect on is that it's quite interesting that how diverse the different nanoparticles that we produce are. And so virtually you now could have so many number of particles that are created by using the different kinds of compounds, so different spacer or different alkyl chain lengths in different ratios with the nucleic acid, with the DNA. So even just in this small sample of particles, if we combine it with four different ratios between the DNA and the Gemini cationic surfactant, we get, if we look at their internal structure by Sachs, we get different kinds of polymorphic structures for these particles. And what's interesting for us is that when we decrease the ratio between the DNA and the cationic surfactants, that is, you don't have tenfold excess of the cationic charge over the DNA, the change in polymorphic structure is going to change as well. And what we are speculating, that's our working hypothesis right now, is that when the nanoparticle enters the cell, there is this association of the Gemini surfactant from the nucleic acid. So we could predict a kind of a trend like this, and there will be less and less Gemini surfactant associated with the DNA as the nanoparticle is going through the different compartments of the cell intracellularly. And that also means that we will see change in the morphology of that particle as well. And we think that this morphology change is important how that nanoparticle works, whether it's efficient or not. And so for the different ones, we can follow these nanoparticle structural changes. And when we look at the transfection efficiency, we find that in this order, from the green to the blue to the red, that there is different morphological structural properties to these nanoparticles. And so if we want to correlate the structure with the transfection efficiency, then we want to understand what kind of structure does it have and which one contributes to higher efficiency compared to the other. So what we are finding that those particles who have a single structure, such as either lamellar or hexagonal, they don't work as efficiently than those that actually are very flexible and capable of changing from one polymorphic state to the other state. So this is something that is emerging as some kind of correlation between nanoparticle structural property and efficacy. Of course, we would like to go and advance these types of particles for clinical trial. And through our disease model work and efficacy work, we are able to make progress in terms of application for these nanoparticles in the clinic. It doesn't necessarily mean that we understand everything about the formulation yet, but nevertheless, when you have clinical efficacy or some kind of understanding of these clinical properties, then it's possible to start moving forward. The other area that we are also looking at is the application of carbon nanotubes. And these carbon nanotubes are one type of allotropes of carbon, and the other ones are diamond and graphite. There is also closed cages of carbon that are called buckyballs. The pharmaceutical area is quite interested in both the buckyballs, but very much interested in the application of single and multivolt carbon nanotubes as drug carriers. There are different types of nanotubes that can be employed, and we are still at the very early stages of the applications because we don't know enough about what diameter, what length, what would be the ideal properties for these nanotubes for use. But there is a lot of interest, and we have to develop specifications for these nanotubes to be able to be approved for any kind of use. There is a lot of work now in the cancer field to use nanotubes to carry small cancer molecules, proteins, and targeting agents on their surface. So in my lab, we are interested in pharmaceutical characterization for these nanotubes as well. And what we did was that we used multivolt carbon nanotubes, coated them with the Gemini surfactants, and bound plasmid DNA or siRNA to the surface. And using these carbon nanotubes, we were looking at transfection efficiency and delivery into the cell. And what we find compared to even other systems that very early on, at 1 hour, we already see gene expression of the green fluorescence protein using these GFP coding plasmid DNA in a multivalent nanotube system. And the expression increases continuously up to 8 hours or so, but even beyond 12 hours, up to 24 hours, we see gene expression sustained using these kinds of systems. When we deliver siRNA, we see similar trend. Here, the siRNA is the red. It's actually a labeled compound, so we actually can follow the pathway that this nucleic acid takes to get into the cell. We see endocytotic processes that are taking place in the cell, and up to 12 hours, we see very high level of association. The originally early stage, when the siRNA is bound to the external surface, we can see internalization into the cells, and the siRNA will be located in the perinuclear area after a few hours. So other reports when applying carbon nanotube systems indicate similar types of phenomena, except what the confusion is about is that when you use different types of functionalized carbon nanotubes, there are many opportunities to put certain surface characteristics on the surface of the carbon nanotubes. That's because you want to functionalize it so you can bind a drug compound to it, an antibody to it, some kind of a diagnostic label on the surface. There is a lot of conflicting data that's coming through as to what is the nature of the uptake, how much uptake is happening, and there are reports of non-energy dependent uptake processes. That means that is not endocytosis that's happening. In some other cases, there is passive diffusion that's reported. And with carbon nanotubes, because of the very high aspect ratio, very skinny but very long, there is suggestions that maybe these go through like a dart across the membrane. You don't even need to get it internalized. You don't really need to form coated pits to encapsulate into the lysosomal compartment at all. So there is a lot of interesting information that's happening. Some report that the nanotubes will be located in the cytoplasm and they stay there. Some studies show that when PEG is coupled to the surface of the nanotube, they will be going and located. The green is the label for the nanotubes, will be in the nuclei of the cells, and they accumulate in the nuclei. There is other studies that have been shown that the nanotubes can go into the cell, but there is bidirectional uptake. So what goes in, if you remove the nanotubes from the outside, they will start coming out from the cell. So there is some kind of a process that's happening in the cell that is capable of expelling these nanotubes. So there is a lot of issues that are happening. What is the size that's important? What size of nanoparticles will be cleared from the system and by what route? So when we look at in vivo phage, and they look at urine samples, whether the nanotubes are excreted in mice, they find that any of the very small nanotubes are excreted through the kidneys. And this would be consistent with the notion that anything that's probably smaller than about 8 nanometers will be excreted through the kidneys, and they are not going to be processed or recognized by RES. But they also found that the large ones, which are shown here in this area, those are the aggregated nanotubes. They will be just sitting in glomerular areas, and they don't get excreted. So there is a huge difference in terms of what kind of nanotubes, or whether they are formulated properly, whether they are single nanotubes or they are bundles of nanotubes together. So I just wanted to illustrate this aspect, because some people in the nanomedicine area, who a lot of us are working on different types of nanoparticle systems, from lipids to polymers to solid and semi, you know, like soft nanoparticles, are saying now that what's out there in with regards to understanding the behavior of these particles is a nano chaos, because number one, there is a huge variety of nanoparticle systems that are available and people are working on. Number two, when they publish papers, only some of the information is published, because either it's not known or some details are never make it, you know, to that level in the paper. And so when we look at and want to build an understanding of what aspect of the properties are crucial, we can never get the full picture. And we have to do something to create a more systematic approach to be able to collect this information. Scott McNeil, who is at the Nanotechnology Characterization Laboratory, created this figure. And this is to reflect on how the combination of properties of nanoparticles will influence their biological fate, and what kind of effect we can expect from it. So particles that are under the 220 nanometer size range or so, with high solubility or low solubility, surface charge characteristics and size, would have different biocompatibilities and cytotoxicity. So they would be either recognized if they are large enough and they have lower solubility and they are circulating, compared to those that are very small and they can be cleared very easily through the bile or the kidneys. And if they have high surface charge activity, that they might be very cytotoxic. And then any combination of these properties, you might be able to predict their biocompatibility. So we need to build some kind of a database of some sort where we can sort of combine all the properties and have a better understanding. Nanoparticle classifications can come in different ways, and very recently, Gentleman and Chen published a paper where they are suggesting a classification system based on seven different properties that includes chemical class, size and shape, core chemistry, ligand chemistry and solubility, and coding all these properties. And so for each particle that somebody would like to do studies or publications would come out, they would have to disclose these properties so that we all would have a better understanding that what were the particles that were used. In the CNT literature that I showed you, there are papers there where organic solvents are being used to administer the carbon nanotubes, for example, and there's a lot of confusion whether is the nanotubes that are toxic or the solvents themselves. The purity of the carbon nanotubes also play a huge role. A lot of the bulk material that you buy to create these nanosystems are very impure. There is metallic catalysts in there. So the 2006, when the first papers came out to look at the toxicity aspect of carbon nanotubes and reported toxic effects, apoptosis, oxidative stress to the cells, and only a couple of years later they realized that it was due to the metallic impurities that were present in those nanoparticle formulations. So when we are designing all these treatment methods, we still have a lot of work to do to be able to understand the nanoparticles and the building blocks for that. There is also new efforts by Don Tomalia and his co-workers on creating a nanoperiodic system that would look at very crucial properties of different nanomaterials based on how many atoms, what is the mass of the atoms, whether this is monodispersed or polydispersed systems, and assign categories for both hard and soft nanoparticles. So this is a huge effort to try to characterize nanomaterials. So similarly to the chemical periodic table that we have. Now, we may end up having a nanoparticle periodic table that we can cross-reference, and we would be able to predict their biological behavior in vivo as well. So what's important to parameters for nanoparticles, these are generally recognized: size, shape, surface charge, hydrophobicity. In medicine, we have known this for quite a long time. There will be other properties that we'll have to introduce. So the critical nanoscale design parameters by Tomalia also look at surface chemistry and flexibility, not just size and shape. And we also need to look at quantitative properties, single particle versus bulk. I work a lot of times with bulk materials. If you show me one particle, this is the aspects of this particle, aspect ratio, size or shape, or it's fine. But when I work with bulk, there is going to be a range of all these particle properties. How can I tell that if I have 10% that's outside of a certain range, how it will affect biocompatibility functionality? So on my closing slide, I wanted to reflect on this, that there is a lot of properties that will be very important: size, surface area, shape, charge, coatings, stability, and internal structure. That's what we have seen from the Gemini particles. And bulk properties, so when you look at the stuff, you know, the carbon nanotubes, size distribution, solubility, what medium they will be dispersed in and administered, or the dosage form, and purity as well. So there is a lot of pharmaceutical, physical, chemical, and medical toxicological work that still need to take place. But I think the amount of data is going to be so much that how to handle this. I think this is where we come to the point that, you know, some kind of, you know, database or much more systematic approach that would be necessary to be able to make more sense out of what we have already and be more effective in designing new types of particles. Thank you very much. Very, very good question. It's a very usual approach from regulatory agencies, which means that whoever is developing these nanoparticles will have to do sufficient and extensive studies to demonstrate their safety and efficacy. So it's always on the onus is on the companies or the groups developing it. So